Kings chapter 9. We covered first part of 1 Kings 9 last week, was looking at God's answer to Solomon's prayer. He spent all of chapter 8 praying about the temple. Lord, sanctify this place. Listen to the people who pray in it. And in chapter 9, verses 1 through 13 or so, God answered that prayer and said, "Yes, I've done that, but you and the people of Israel had better be careful to follow all of my law. Keep my word, do my commandments, or I will kick the people out of this land." It's not God being cruel, it's him being honest. God's holiness doesn't tolerate sin. Yes, he loves us. That's why he sent Christ to die for us, because he is both loving and holy. If God were just loving, he could look at our sin and say, "Eh, not a big deal, never mind." But he is holy, so he couldn't just let the sin pass, right? So, but because he loves us and if he were just holy, he could say, "Well, you guys blew it. Forget it. You're done. That was your last shot. You only get one chance and you missed it. So fooey on you." But he didn't, because he's loving and he's holy. All of God's attributes work in perfect harmony. It's not that one is contradictory to the other, but they completely complement one another, right? So God answered that prayer, said, "Yes, I have sanctified this place." Now in verse 10, through the rest of the chapter, we really are going to get a look at Solomon's kingdom in sort of a choppy fashion. Every couple of verses is going to be a bit of a new topic, but everything that's going to be covered here is relates to how Solomon is improving the kingdom. So some of you have bought houses, and I imagine that over the years there have just been a constant string of improvements going on. You build this, you build that, you replace this, right? So you start with one thing. Eldon, you dug a basement in your house, didn't you? Yep. And I know, Gary, you've talked about redoing the siding on yours and planting fruit trees in the back. And Patricia, you had a partition put on the house or an addition there on the back. Dan, you've built a garage on the back of yours. So, I mean, you get a house, and there's just usually a constant string of improvements or repairs. Well, that's what Solomon is doing. Remember, we looked back at David's life, and we said David's life, for the most part, was establishing the kingdom. He was putting the house in place. We talked this morning about multi-generational faithfulness. God didn't build the kingdom of Israel in one generation. Not even one day. He built it in several generations. So we even can go back as far as Saul in the beginning to say, where were the foundations of this kingdom laid? It was laid with Saul, and even before that in Samuel. So this is multi-generational stuff that we're looking at. David established the dynasty that would rule over the southern part for the next 500 years. David made the kingdom secure enough that it could begin to grow. Because when David first became king, Israel was threatened on every side by enemies. You had the Philistines. I have our map up here so we can sort of refresh our memories. With Judah and Israel here in the middle, surrounding this Jordan River Valley, bottomed on the south here by the Dead Sea and on the north by the Sea of Galilee. They had the Philistines over here next to the sea. You had the Amalekites down here in the southern deserts. You had the Moabites over here in the eastern deserts. The Amorites, the Ammonites, the Edomites way down here in the south. So they are just surrounded by enemies, and intermingled within them, the Canaanites, that they were never able to fully drive out of the land. So David, when he began his kingdom, his main purpose was to secure it and to make sure that that house wouldn't get destroyed by enemies. Solomon's life is going to be spent expanding it, building it, making it more glorious. And so we're going to see some of those things in what Solomon does here. Verse 10, "At the end of 20 years in which Solomon had built the two houses, the house of the Lord and the king's house." We've referenced this time frame before. Solomon reigns for how many years? 40, right? Same that Saul did, same that David did, and right about where Saul did. So 40 years he's on the throne. How long was he on the throne before he started building? not seventh. Kim's just throwing out numbers here. It's multiple choice and there's only four options. So, all right. It was the fourth year of his reign. All right. Fourth year of his reign, he begins building the house of the Lord, and it takes him 20 years to build the temple and his own palace. So we're looking now at, you're in 24, 25 years after Solomon took the throne. We're well over halfway through it at this point. So that gives us some perspective. Now, David reigned for 40 years. Saul was on the throne for about 40 years. So we are now 100 years into the kingdom section of Israel's history. Before Saul, you have about 350 years of the period of the judges. So they enter the land under Joshua. They subdue many of the Canaanite kingdoms. They establish themselves in the land. And then for the next 350 years, was it up or down? Think back to the book of Judges. What was happening in the book of Judges? It was sometimes up, sometimes down. Key phrase in the book of Judges, in those days there was no king in Israel, and every man did that which was right in his own eyes. And you end the book of Judges with a couple of accounts of the atrocities that were happening, like the concubine, the Levite's concubine, who was raped by the entire town of one of the Benjamite cities. And then the civil war that followed, and Benjamin being nearly completely wiped out. So the whole point of the book of Judges is to show how bad life was in Israel with no king. The system of judges that they were operating under wasn't functioning well. The people were not adhering to God's law on their own. And so God established the kingship by choosing Saul, and then by choosing David, and now Solomon. So David really establishes it. Saul's whole point seems to be to show us what a king should not be like. He did accomplish securing the kingdom in some ways by conquering Israel's enemies, but it was really David that put the kingdom on sure foundation, and now Solomon is expanding it. So we are talking about 24, 25 years into Solomon's reign here. So at the end of 20 years, in which Solomon had built the two houses, the house of the Lord and the king's house, and Hiram, king of Tyre, had supplied Solomon with cedar and cypress timber and gold, as much as he desired. King Solomon gave to Hiram 20 cities in the land of Galilee. So again, back to our map, let's refresh our minds as to what's going on here. Israel lives in this area between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea. This greenish section, does it look green up on your screen? Yeah. That color actually looks a lot better up there than this does. This greenish section over here on the coast of the Mediterranean is for the most part Philistine, which were subjugated by David. So David subjugated all these kingdoms around Israel, and now they're paying tribute in the form of taxes to Israel, right? So the Israelites live here. Up here is the region of Tyre and Sidon. This is its own independent kingdom. It was not subjugated to Israel because they were always on friendly terms with Israel. David and Hiram, or Hiram's father, had a very good relationship. And so the king of Tyre and Sidon, Hiram, and Solomon had a good relationship throughout their reign. And one of the ways that we know they had this good relationship is this agreement. Where did Solomon get all the lumber that he needed for the temple? Well, it was from the region of Tyre and Sidon and Lebanon, which is farther up here. These people knew how to cut lumber. They knew how to work with wood. They're like Dan. They're master carpenters. Okay. I guess we'd call you a craftsman, not a carpenter. There's a little subtle distinction, I guess. Carpenters usually build buildings. Dan does more detailed work. Right? So Dan's our master craftsman back there. That's what the Sidonians and the Tyrians were like. Especially when it came to shipbuilding, and that's going to come into the narrative here in a little bit. But they had this agreement where Hiram would supply much of the building material that Solomon needed for all of his building projects. And the agreement here was that Solomon would give King Hiram 20 cities in the land of Galilee. Now, Galilee you're probably familiar with because of the life of Christ. He spent a lot of time ministering up here in Galilee. Galilee is this region over on the western side of the Sea of Galilee. Makes sense, right? This was a predominantly Canaanite region, so it most likely had not been settled by Israelites up to this point. Solomon conquered them, or David conquered them, but Solomon had them in his possession, and he gave them to Hiram as a present, or as repayment for all of this help that Hiram had delivered to Israel. Makes sense, because right here is Tyre, and Galilee is very close to there. So Hiram gets these 20 cities. Now, we're talking cities. We're not talking like Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, right? There are, I'm not sure there are any ancient cities that number in the millions. You're talking cities might consist of hundreds of people. It's hard for us to imagine because we live in a world that is highly populated. Who, was that you, Gary, were telling me that it was like 1960 we crossed the 4 billion mark? Okay. 4 billion people. So way back then we crossed into 4 billion. Right now we're 7.5, maybe 8 billion people. You go back to this time in history and there might be a couple of millions of people living in the world. So you're talking about a very sparsely populated world. You have several million in Israel. You might have several million over in Acadia and Babylon. So not many more than maybe 50 million people living in the entire world at this point. And you know, so they were probably arguing, what are we going to do when we cross 100 million? How are we going to feed all these people? Where are they all going to live, right? They do that every time we cross a major barrier. I guess we got to go to Mars now. We'll have to colonize the city. So everybody will have to become friends with Elon Musk. He's got the plan, doesn't he? All right, so he gives Hiram these 20 cities in the land of Galilee. Verse 12, this would almost be humorous if it weren't so serious. But when Hiram came from Tyre to see the cities that Solomon had given him, they did not please him. So Solomon and Hiram take this tour of these 20 cities, and Hiram's looking around and saying, I gave you how much lumber and how much gold and how much other goods, and you're repaying me with these things? So they apparently were not very good cities. Now I want you to turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 8, because we're going to do a little comparative study here. That is, verse 13 I'll read here real quick. Therefore he said, what kind of cities are these that you have given me, my brother? So they are called to the land of Kabul to this day. Kabul is a word that means something like ripped off. So how many of you live in the city of I got ripped off? Yeah, no. Well, Kabul, that was kind of that area. So if you go to 1 Chronicles chapter 8, I'm trying to turn there. My hands are not finding these things. Oh, wait. Nope, that's not right. Is it 18? No. Is it 2 Chronicles 8? I'm sorry. 2 Chronicles 8. Let's try that. All right. 2 Chronicles 8, then, is the parallel passage. Very similar. A couple of details that are important for us, though. 2 Chronicles 8:1, at the end of 20 years in which Solomon had built the house of the Lord in his own house, Solomon rebuilt the cities that Hiram had given to him and settled the people of Israel in them. So there's a little bit of a different detail, but what does this tell us about those 20 cities? They were given back. Hiram thought they were so worthless that he just gave them back to Solomon. And then what did Solomon do with them? He resettled people in them. He took Israelites up there to start rebuilding it. So, not a great thing for the relationship between Hiram and Solomon, but it didn't seem to phase things too much. But that's why when you get to the time of Christ, there are Israelites living all through Galilee. because Hiram didn't like these cities, he gave them back to Solomon, and Solomon then started rebuilding them. So they're called the land of Kabul. Apparently people didn't like living there much either. But Hiram had sent to the king 120 talents of gold. So along with all of the timber and the meal, the foodstuffs, and the carpenters and the, everything that Hiram sent to Solomon, there was this monetary amount, 120 talents of gold. All right, so how much is a talent? Those of you that have study Bibles can look in your margins now and tell me how much is a talent of gold. About 75 pounds, all right? What's the price of gold per ounce? I looked it up just this afternoon just to make sure. It's $1,240-some. So we'll round it up to $1,250, okay? $1,250 per ounce of gold today, and 75 pounds of gold. What does that come out? What's 75 times 16 ounces? Gives you about 1,200 ounces. And I did this earlier on a calculator. That's why I'm doing it so fast now, okay? I shouldn't. Yeah, it would have looked really good, right? I have a slide rule for a brain. 1,200 ounces times about $1,250 works out to be $1.5 million. So, Hiram obviously has been a big supporter of Solomon. Go ahead, Eldon. Yeah, That tells you how far the dollar has slidden in value. That now it takes $1,250 to buy an ounce of gold, where it used to take 35, right? So, yeah, money, paper money is losing a lot of value. But anyway, so he's given him this much money. Well, that's, I'm sorry. That's $1.5 million per talent. I forgot. It's $120. Talents. Am I doing this right? Or did I do that already? Yeah. $180 million. You're doing that on your calculator? Yep, okay. Ethan's back there at the sound booth and he's got the calculator up in the computer. So yeah, I forgot about the 120 talents. So yeah, this is $180 million that Hiram has given Solomon. That's a lot of money. And if any of you think that's not a lot of money, you're either a politician or you should be a generous donor to the Kelly Vacation Fund. Right? Verse 15, this is the account of the forced labor that King Solomon drafted to build the house of the Lord and his own house and the Milo and the wall of Jerusalem and Hazor and Megiddo and Gezer. So, where did Solomon get all the people to do this hard, laborious work? Like I say to my children, anything's possible when you have an endless supply of slave labor. Or children, right. All right, so Solomon had a workforce of forced laborers. Now, we do need to be careful that we don't read into this concept of forced laborers what we tend to think of in slavery. It was not quite the same. Did they have to do the work? Yes, they did. Were they whipped and mistreated all day long? No. Why not? Because that doesn't make for very good workers, right? The work output drops tremendously when you mistreat your workers, and they understood that. So you can make a biblical point for freedom. Yes, the Old Testament does allow for slavery in some forms, but the Old Testament also put a lot of safeguards on slavery. You weren't allowed to mistreat your workers or you had to let them go. So if you struck a slave and knocked out his tooth, guess what? He went free because of that. And you were supposed to be paying your workers while they were working for you. So there were a lot of safeguards going into slavery so that a lot of times the things we see in Scripture that are talking about slavery are not the modern concept of slaves where they're just getting whipped and beaten, mistreated all the time. Okay, I'm sure that did happen in some cases, but that's not the biblical picture. So he has these forced laborers rebuilding all these things. And just a real quick rundown through those work projects. The temple we've looked at. The house of Solomon we've looked at, his own palace. The Millo is a fortification in Jerusalem that David built. And so this isn't Solomon constructing a new building. This is Solomon improving upon what his dad had already set in place. We don't know a whole lot about it other than that it was there. But it was some kind of stronghold that David could go into. Hazor and Megiddo and Gezer, these are all cities, and we know where several of them are. Let me see if I can increase the font names here. It might not help you. Can you read Hazor right there? It's kind of small. It's a little small. Let me see if I can. If I do more, you won't be able to read the other names. But right there is Hazor. The Sea of Galilee is here. So Hazor is a city on the northern end of Galilee. Would have been important for guarding the country from invaders from the north, right? Megiddo, I'm going to shrink the text now because you need to see where this is at. Megiddo is an important place. This greenish strip that stretches from the Mediterranean over to the Jordan River Valley is called the Valley of Jezreel. It's an important place because, number one, it's extremely fertile, produces a ton of crops, and number two, because it's flat land, you can have military campaigns there. A lot of battles get fought in the region of Jezreel. In fact, this is the plain where Saul was killed in his final battle with the Philistines back in 1 Samuel. So he was killed up here in this area of Jezreel. Located right around here in the Valley of Jezreel is a town called Megiddo. And it was situated along the trade routes that ran north and south through the area of Israel. You've got to understand, Israel was located, it's prime real estate. It's small, and a lot of it's desert land. But what isn't desert land is extremely fertile, and it is on the trade routes between Asia, Europe, and Africa. So, for the most part, if you want to take a land caravan from Europe to Africa, you got to go through Israel. If you want to go from Africa to Asia, you got to go through Israel. Prime real estate. I don't think that's a mistake in God's purposes for this country. But anyway, Megiddo is situated there toward the south end of the plain of Jezreel. Anybody know a New Testament occurrence that's going to happen in Megiddo? The battle that we call Armageddon. Armageddon. All right, it's the same word, it's the same place. This is where Antichrist is going to gather his forces to try and stop Christ from returning. It's going to be in that Valley of Jezreel around the city of Megiddo. So really important place in biblical history, and Solomon helped fortify it. The town of Gezer is down here, right on the southern end of the Judean foothills, just before the land starts really transitioning into desert. When you get down into this area far in the south, you're really talking about desert-like places, not much growing there, and so it's not very fertile ground. Gezer would have been another fortress city that guarded the trade route from Egypt up through Israel. Now, here's the interesting story that the chronicler, the historian, gives us about the town of Gezer, verse 16. Pharaoh, king of Egypt, had gone up and captured Gezer and burned it with fire and had killed the Canaanites who lived in the city and had given it as dowry to his daughter, Solomon's wife. So Solomon rebuilt Gezer. So here's this city that's situated right in the middle of Israel. But Israel's never been able to kick out the Canaanite inhabitants. This was a perennial problem for Israel. They allowed the Canaanites to stay in the land. It's a picture, by the way, of allowing sin in your life. The things you don't kick out will eventually conquer you. And that's shown up time and time again throughout the history of Israel. But anyway, they weren't able to kick these Canaanites out. So Pharaoh came up from Egypt, conquered a city in the middle of Israel, and then gave the city to his daughter so that she could have a dowry. Now, this concept of a dowry kind of has fallen on hard times in modern mentality. Ladies, how many of you, your father gave you a dowry when he gave you away to be married? Anybody do that? It doesn't happen too much. We have switched it for the dad pays for the wedding. The father of the bride usually pays for the wedding. It's kind of what we've improvised there, but it has none of the same significance. The dowry, there were a couple of different things. There was a bride price, which the groom paid to the girl's father. And this was not saying that she was a piece of property, but it was saying that she was a valuable part of the family economy. And so, you know, Dan, you're recognizing that Linda is such a valuable part of her parents' family economy that if you take her out of that, they need some help. And so you would give a bride price. And of course, if you were a wealthy family, it was more. If you were a poor family, it was less. And so the groom gave a bride price to the bride's father. The dowry was money that The dowry was money that the father of the bride would give to his bride as sort of an insurance policy, so that if anything ever happened to her husband, she would have something to fall back on. So if he would abandon her, or if he would get killed, or if he would get sick and injured, she had some means of being self-supported. Right? So that's what the dowry was. So when Pharaoh gives his daughter this city, it is probably with the intention that any of the taxes collected there go to her. That's her income. That's what is going to help support her. So Solomon takes that city and rebuilds it. Obviously, because he loves his wife and wants her to have a better return out of this bride price, so he rebuilds the city of Gezer. So that's one of his projects. Continuing in verse 17 there, Lower Beth-horon, Baalath, and Tamar in the wilderness in the land of Judah. And these are cities, some of them we know where they are, some of them we don't, but Solomon was rebuilding all of these cities, making them better places. Verse 19, and all the store cities that Solomon had, and the cities for his chariots, and the cities for his horsemen, and whatever Solomon desired to build in Jerusalem, in Lebanon, and in all the land of his dominion. So basically, Solomon has building projects going on all over the place. He's fortifying cities. He's storing up military weapons. He's storing up chariots and horses and armor and weaponry and food and everything necessary to support an army. You know what I found fantastically interesting in studying the life of our founding fathers was how many of them resisted the concept of a standing military because they thought it would be a means of tyranny. They were very resistant to having any kind of standing army. They wanted to rely completely upon militia. And it was George Washington who finally had to convince them that we can't rely totally on militia. They're an important part of this thing. But militia typically don't perform well in battle. They're usually the first ones to run. They're not very organized. They're not very disciplined. But many of the founding fathers, their idea was that if you have a standing army, what does it take to support them? Money. And a lot of it. Armies are expensive. Every time our country goes to war, we kind of find that out anew, that we got to spend billions and billions of dollars supporting an army. And some people react kind of badly to that. But our founding fathers looked at it and said, well, if you have to spend out all of this money to support a standing army in a time of peace, you're going to have to tax the people to get that money, and that's going to be a means of tyranny to your people under you. You're just going to have to raise taxes in order to support this. Well, Solomon apparently thought more like George Washington than he did like some of the other founding fathers, and he had a big standing army in order to protect Israel. And so he built storehouses, and he built weapons houses, and he built magazine cities all over the nation of Israel so that the entire place could be safe and protected. All the store cities. And he just finally, in those last phrases of the verse, whatever he desired to build in Jerusalem and Lebanon and all the land of his dominion. So this doesn't even cover everything. We learn more from the book of Ecclesiastes. What else did Solomon like to build? I know everybody reads the book of Ecclesiastes for the devotions because it's so uplifting, right? Tim? Later in life, yes, he's going to start building temples for his wives so they can worship. That's what you were going to say. You know, Ecclesiastes 1 and 2, Solomon talks about all his building projects, and he mentions in their gardens and houses that he built. I mean, he had stuff all over the place. He really made Israel a beautiful land to be in. Verse 20, all the people who were left of the Amorites, this is continuing the thought back in verse 15 about the forced labor. So all of the construction projects that we mentioned, the different cities, that's an insert to tell you what he was doing with this forced labor. So we're continuing on now with this concept of forced labor. Who were the forced labor? All the people who were left of the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, who are not of the people of Israel. Their descendants who were left after them in the land, whom the people of Israel were unable to devote to destruction, these Solomon drafted to be slaves, so that they are, and so they are to this day. But the people of Israel, Solomon made no slaves. They were the soldiers, his officials, his commanders, his captains, his chariot commanders, and his horsemen. So the common laborer, the guy lugging stone from the quarry to the building site, would have been your forced laborer, some of the Canaanites or the Amorites that were living in the land. The person overseeing the work would have been an Israelite. He didn't make forced labor out of the Israelites. All right? So there is sort of this division that's going on in Solomon's kingdom, and this explains how he was able to get all this building done with forced labor. Verse 23, these were the chief officers who were over Solomon's work, 550 who had the charge of the people who carried on the work. So Solomon's got 550 officers who oversee all these building projects. How many civil engineers do you think work in Illinois overseeing all the whole state? Anybody ever heard a number? I don't have any idea. I do know the comptroller, Mendoza? I think it's Mendoza. Just said, we don't have enough money to pay our bills. I know. Verse 24, but Pharaoh's daughter went up from the city of David to her own house that Solomon had built for her, and then he built the Millo. So not only does Solomon build a temple and his own palace, but he builds a special palace just for this, his first wife. Unfortunately, that's not going to be the only wife he takes on, which we'll find out later. But for this one, he does build a special palace. I won't ask for a show of hands of how many women would love for your husband to build you a whole separate house where you can go and live, right? So, buy me the house across town. I'll go live there. You stay here. So, three times a year, Solomon used to offer up burnt offerings and peace offerings on the altar that he built to the Lord, making offerings with it before the Lord. And so he finished the house. This is talking about the temple. It's talking about that huge bronze altar that sat in front of the temple. So whereas before constructing the temple, Solomon and many other people worshipped at the high places, now things are transitioning so that that temple is becoming the central location for worship in Israel. And Solomon's leading that example. Verse 26, here's another one of Solomon's hobbies. Solomon built a fleet of ships at Ezion-Geber, which is near Eloth on the shore of the Red Sea in the land of Edom. I'm going to show you real quick where this is at, so let me zoom out and give you an idea here. This is the land of Israel. This right down here is the Red Sea. It has two prongs. This is the Red Sea, and this is called the Gulf of Aqaba, Red Sea. And right here on the tip of it is the city of Ezion-Geber. It is in the land of Edom. The Edomites dwelt in all this area here. The Moabites lived up here. The Midianites lived farther south. So right here in the land of Edom, I guess that would be modern-day Kuwait, wouldn't it? I'm not real good on my modern geography, but I think that'd be Kuwait. So he builds a fleet of ships at Ezion-Geber in this place, and Hiram sent with the fleet his servants, seamen who were familiar with the sea, together with the servants of Solomon. From other places in Scripture, namely the Second Chronicles passage, we get the indication in 1 Kings chapter 10, which we'll get to here in a couple of weeks. Hiram had fleets of ships already built down there on the Red Sea. Now, Hiram, his kingdom is up here. Why would he have a fleet of ships down here so far south? I mean, his country doesn't even connect to that. Why would a king on a small kingdom on the Mediterranean Sea want a fleet of ships down in the Red Sea? Probably for trade. I mean, what can you access from the Red Sea that you can't access from the Mediterranean Sea? Saudi Arabia, India, the Far East. I mean, his ships were going all over the place. Tyre and Sidon were fabulously wealthy cities. Hiram was one of the reasons it was that way. So because Hiram already has a fleet down there, he and his buddy Solomon get this plan to build another fleet with a specific purpose in verse 28, and they went to Ophir. We don't really know where Ophir is at. We're not sure of this designation. They brought from there gold, 420 talents, and they brought it to King Solomon. So Ethan, one talent of gold is about $1.5 million. How much is 420 talents? He's going to do our math back there. $630 million. This trade expedition brings in for Solomon $630 million. That'd be a pretty good return on profits, wouldn't it? Right. So all of this chapter is sort of explaining to us how was Solomon able to accomplish what he was able to accomplish. Because through his connection with Hiram, through all the forced labor that he had, and through these trade expeditions that he went on, God was bringing fantastic wealth into this little kingdom of Israel. It was a fabulously wealthy place. We're going to see a reference here in just the next chapter that says, you know, silver was worthless in the days of Solomon because there was so much of it floating around. But gold was still valuable. So this chapter just gives us this description of Solomon and some of the undertakings that he had. We're going to keep going with those things in the second half of chapter 10. First half of chapter 10 is the Queen of Sheba. Second half of the chapter 10 are some more of Solomon's hobbies and his undertakings. And then in chapter 11, we start looking at his descent from godliness until we get to the end of chapter 11 and the end of Solomon's reign. So any questions about anything that we have covered there? Eldon.